You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Paul Bloom.
Hello, Robert Wright. It's good to see you.
Good to see you, Paul. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright. Excuse me. Publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. You're Paul Bloom, publisher of Small Potatoes Newsletter. By the way, Paul, as you may have heard, there's a new offering on offer from both newsletters, and here's the way it works. If you're a paid subscriber, here's how it works. I don't know if I remember to give you a heads up on this, but here's the way it's going to work, Paul. If you are a paid subscriber to either of our newsletters, you get a 50% discount on a one-year paid subscription to the other newsletter. Remarkable as that sounds. I know, too good to be true, right?
That is too good a deal.
It can't be true. That's what I was thinking, and yet they tell me it is. It's amazing.
So you're saying that someone who's a subscriber, a paid subscriber, Small Potatoes, will get 50% off Non-Zero and vice versa?
Paul, I could not have put it better myself. The way it works is they go to the to either place and to the post that corresponds to this podcast, and below the paywall, they will find a magic link, if they can get below the paywall, to the 50% subscription to the 50% off subscription to the other place. It
sounds too good to be true.
It's too good to be true, but we shouldn't really dwell on this, Paul.
Well, I'm going to
figure it out. We'll explain how this is possible, and we'll figure that out and explain next week.
Once we finish our discussions, I then the next day get sent the video, and I post it on Small Potatoes as well as Beyond the Paywall, our overtime segment. And I always try to choose an interesting title based on it. And the title for this one might be Paul and Robert are entirely unprepared.
Oh, I don't know about that, Paul.
Well, okay, one of us is unprepared.
I am entirely unprepared. No, it's true that we both have our reasons for... Look, no excuse. Let's make the excuses
meta.
Let's start with this. The Barry Weiss trivia quiz, okay? As people may have heard, she's apparently going to be running CBS News now that Larry Ellison's son, after spending a long time arduously gathering the money that a billionaire's son has to gather to buy Paramount, which owns CBS, he has decided to put Barry Weiss in charge of CBS News. Now, the trivia question is, how can we be sure that Barry Weiss, when she's running CBS News, will not be a Donald Trump toady?
How can we be sure of that?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I never thought of Barry Weiss as a Donald Trump toady.
That's not a direct answer to the question, but I mean, it's interesting.
Is it a rhetorical question?
No, there's an answer. There's a correct answer and incorrect. And you haven't even given us an incorrect one yet.
We should rehearse.
Let's start over.
Go ahead. No, I do not know. So my answer would be because she is not, in fact, a Donald Trump toady.
The answer is she can't be a Donald Trump toady because she literally does not know the meaning of the word toady. Now, apparently you aren't in touch with the famous clip of her on Joe Rogan when she says, well, Tulsi Gabbard is an Assad toady, referring to the former leader of Syria. And Rogan, in his endearing earnestness and spontaneousness, says, what does toady mean? And she goes, and fumbles for like, I don't know, it seemed like 5 hours. It was so enjoyable. And finally, Jamie looks it up and tells her what it means. It's a famous clip. People should check it out.
I have never heard of this clip.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. I mean, you know, it's good. But there's a second. Well, go ahead. There's a second trivia question.
Kind of in a more Chomskyan mode. Often we could use language fluently and correctly, following unconscious rules, but struggle to articulate. So the Tulsi Gabbard claim about the toady is being used, I imagine, perfectly correct.
That was spoken like a Barry Weiss toady.
I don't know the meaning of the word.
Like the Barry Weiss toady that you are.
You know, I've met Barry Weiss.
It's a great clip. Now, here is part two of the Barry Weiss trivia quiz. So, as you know, She's a long been a crusader for free speech, particularly on campus. So this question is, with that as backdrop, when did her name first appear in the New York Times and in what context, Paul?
I think I'm going to get this right, actually.
Oh, yeah?
I have not looked at the story or primary sources, but I understand that she was involved in a movement somehow to get fired or something like that for a pro-Palestinian faculty member.
She was trying to get a faculty member disciplined who, as it happens, had pro-Palestinian sentiments.
So I'm right. I'm right.
You're right. But you missed the best part. She did this in her capacity as co-founder of Colombians for Academic Freedom. That's my favorite part.
No.
Now, this is relevant, by the way, to the CBS position because...
You know, with this negative criticism, it's going to be hard to see Non-Zero being purchased for $150 million by a billionaire.
You think I've dropped out of the running for David Ellison's next... I'm no longer the apple of his eye.
You are biting the hands that could feed you. Well, small potatoes. It's just on the market.
Have you heard from the Ellisons? Has Small Potatoes gotten an email from the Ellisons?
This is going to be a terrible story, like really boring, but it's going to be short, which is my wife and I are watching The Morning Show. Are you watching that?
Wait, you mean the one on Apple TV that's about?
Yes.
We watch early seasons of it. Right. It's the one. Is Steve Carroll still in it?
No,
he's not.
Not to give any spoilers, but he's dead.
That didn't spoil anything.
Sorry.
So it's about a morning show, a network morning show. Yeah. And
there's
anyway,
enormous amount of machinations. And when my wife heard that Barry Weiss had now become the leader of CBS, she said, that is exactly the sort of thing you would expect to happen to Corey Ellison, who's one of the major characters. And then, like 5 minutes later, we discover it's Larry Ellison who was behind it. Fascinating, though.
That is fascinating. Now, speaking of him,
Larry Ellison or Corey?
Larry and David. By the way, Glenn Greenwald. Not that this has any connection to the fact that Barry Weiss has been hired to run CBS News. Glenn Greenwald tweeted that Larry Ellison is the largest private donor to the IDF and apparently does turn out that between Oracle and Larry himself, $30 million has gone to the Israeli military. Anyway, what I was going to ask was, what newsletter do you think is more likely than yours to hear from the Ellisons about possible purchase?
Possible incorporation? I don't know.
I'm guessing it's the Small Potatoes that's run by a rabbi. It's kind of a joke.
Yeah. Kind of a joke. This is going to be very, very niche. Do you know, I was contacted by Barry Weiss, who by the way, so just to jump in, I think there are two reasons why she became head of the news, got this incredible promotion. One is just, you know, quality. She writes well. She did extremely well starting the Free Press and so on. And another's ideology. Where her ideology is, I imagine Larry Ellison is very sympathetic to it.
I think.
Yeah. There's no conspiratorial thing above and beyond that. They're of sympathetic political views. And
They're open about it.
So here's the story. You may not remember this, but during the heavy time of COVID and the Great Awakening, a visitor came to the grand rounds at Yale, run by the Child Study Center, which is part of medical.
You gotta tell people what grand rounds are in case they're not like, what are grand rounds?
It's like a toady. Grand rounds are it's a talk series. You bring in people to talk. I've actually participated in grand rounds. You bring in people often whose works connects to the research of people doing there or has some clinical skills. And this is on, I took a look at this. I reminded myself by reading the New York Times article. But they bring in this, this like this counselor, clinician from New York City, the Big Apple, to Yale, who gives a talk on, this is not the exact title, but maybe it is actually, the psychopathic mind of white people. And this speaker, apparently cheers and applause, talks about her fantasy of bashing white people's heads in for being so obtuse and so white. And the excerpt.
I know that feeling. I just want to throw that in, but go ahead.
I've heard you give that same talk, this rage.
Well, there are a lot of white people. Well, never mind. Go ahead.
Anyway, it turned out that this thing was taped, but Yale did not want to release it for a while outside of the Yale community. So Barry Weiss, through a friend, reached out to me, and I ended up having a Zoom conversation with her where she asked if I could get access to it.
And you went undercover and you stole it or what?
I did not choose to go undercover, but I got to say, I found her an entirely pleasant and interesting and engaging person to talk to. So Barry, if you're listening to this, you know,
We love you, Barry. But I have one more thing to say about her. At the risk of endangering the relationship I'm otherwise trying to cultivate with her, I just would point out, I mean, for those who have not read my classic 2020 piece, Why Is Everyone So Mean to Barry Weiss? I can't believe there's anyone left who hasn't, but in case you're one of those, I would just point out that the person now running CBS News defines anti-Zionism, says that anti-Zionism constitutes anti-Semitism, notwithstanding the fact that many Jews are anti-Zionist. Mm-hmm. And she also wrote in her book, How to Fight Anti-Semitism, that the ultimate goal of anti-Semitism is, quote, the elimination of Judaism and the Jewish people. So, first of all, it follows that everyone who opposes Zionism, the Zionists, and some people oppose that just because they oppose ethnically based states. Mm-hmm. So they would oppose Islamist states as well, and those exist too. Yeah. But anyway, I would just point out that, so the person running CBS News believes that if you oppose Zionism, you're an anti-Semite. I assume that her policy, like the policy of any self-respecting network, will be to not knowingly give a platform to anti-Semites. So it follows that I don't think we're going to see a lot of criticism of Zionism on CBS News, but we'll see.
A broader question. Mm-hmm. Do you think network news is a good way to go for, this would be a tough job to turn down, I imagine. It's an enormous network.
I'm available.
I'm sure your views would be an interesting contrast to Barry Weiss's. But I mean, do you think 10 years from now we'll be watching CBS network news? Here's a trivia question for you, which I would not know how to answer. Who's the big news person? Is it Walter Cronkite? No, you know, but who's up there? Who's the anchor man, as they call him?
At CBS?
Yeah.
Excellent question. I can tell you the ABC guy. At least I can picture him.
I picture these handsome men with strong jaws, and Fox has attractive blonde women. I know Megyn Kelly.
She's not a Fox anymore.
Oh, that's true. Sorry.
Yeah. It's a good point that I don't even know. And I don't know about it. Is it Lester Holt at NBC? I don't know. Now, the ABC guy. Oh, David Muir, him. I can name one of three, but that's great. You know, it used to be, even 20 years ago, anyone in America could, well, many, many people could name all three. That's how big a deal network news was. It still matters because, for one thing, you know, you got, I guess, a fair number of boomers still watching it. They may hope that somebody with some conversancy in new media like Barry Weiss can help, you know, help it on other platforms like streaming or something. It's not nothing. It's not nothing. No. And it's not nothing that she's now got the money of Paramount behind Free Press. Now, she always had big money. I mean, that I don't think Free Press has ever actually made money. She's, there have been ideologically motivated investors that have kept it afloat. Andreessen Horowitz, very anti-woke and just conservative. David Sacks, very conservative, very anti-woke.
So I'm going to ask, I'm going to play straight man for all this conversation. I have not kept up. But do you see Free Press as fundamentally conservative, pro-Trump thing? Because I've seen stuff from it that seem anti-Trump and pretty eclectic.
No, I don't think. I mean, that's why, I don't think it necessarily will be strongly pro-Trump. I mean, I don't know, is Larry Ellison, I guess he's kind of MAGA adjacent at least, right? Larry Ellison? I think he has been, but I'm not sure. No, I think, I don't know about that part of the ideology. But that reminds me of the other, do you remember we talked about this on a couple of podcasts in the distant past. I guess it was maybe a year or so ago, there were these protests at Yale, and Free Press ran this piece whose lead sentence was, this is almost verbatim, "I was stabbed in the eye because I'm a Jew at Yale." You remember that?
I remember that.
And we mocked it. You had seen the video. I hadn't at that point.
And we actually watched the video in slow motion together, I think.
Yeah, and then, we had a second conversation after we'd both seen the video. It was clearly, I just want to say, the idea that that piece is still up there and there's no correction or anything is not what I would hope for from a periodical run by a person who's going to be running CBS News. But our only disagreement was, so what it really was, first, the woman who, by the way, she was the woman who wrote the piece, who was chair, she was editor-in-chief or chair of the Yale Daily News. Mm-hmm. She was a journalist. But then after the piece, the video came out. She said they had like poked her in the eye with a flagpole or something because she was Jewish. And then the video came out and the guy was waving the flag back and forth. And I actually thought maybe it was kind of an intentional attempt to kind of get in the face, so to speak, of the clearly pro-Israel demonstrators to the left of the people as they marched through. It could have been intentional in that sense. Yeah. He wasn't trying to stab anyone in the eye, didn't stab anyone in the eye. You thought it wasn't even that intentional, but in any event, the word stab has a meaning. She wasn't stabbed in the eye. If you looked closely at her the next day, it looked like there might be a little slightly darker under one eye than the other, but, stab means, do I have to go into detail about what stab means? It's like,
I think stab implies penetration.
Yeah, and it's like, the trajectory of the thrust has to be parallel to the axis of the elongated object that does the stabbing. Okay. It's like if you slit somebody's throat, you didn't stab them. And this guy was just like waving the flag back and forth, possibly in a provocative and belligerent way, possibly not, but it was just, I'm sorry, Paul. I shouldn't get so. But there's good, we should say, by the way, there is good news related to Israel, which is that reportedly the Gaza war is actually over. We don't do much foreign policy here. We're not going to dwell on this, but if it holds, that's good.
We don't do much foreign policy, but I have two questions for you to answer them in any order you choose. The first is, what will this mean for Netanyahu? And the second one is, will Donald Trump get the peace prize he so richly deserves?
Donald Trump will, I think, not be getting the Nobel Peace Prize, unless he does more than this. I don't know about Bibi. I mean, I think that one of his hardcore coalition members in the cabinet, I think Smotrich and maybe also Ben-Gvir, have said they will not support this. I don't know enough about Israeli politics to know what this means. I mean, I think the deal itself will go through. They may have already voted the cabinet today. I don't know. But because for one thing, somebody who's not in Netanyahu's coalition, I forget which leader, said he'll cover, if Netanyahu loses the right on this, he will step in and support him in parliament just for purposes of this. So I guess Israel is going to sign on to this. I don't know what it means for Bibi in the long run. Supposedly kind of resisted it. Trump, it's a deal Trump could have had 5 months ago, Biden could have had, in its broad outlines at least. But something finally inspired Trump to use, you know, a fraction of the leverage he has with Israel. And meanwhile, Hamas's supporters were putting pressure on it to accept this, even though, you know, there's not much in the way of obvious guarantees that Israel will wind up delivering on their end of the deal after the hostages are released. I mean, they'll release the Palestinian prisoners, I'm sure, but there must be more to the deal than that in terms of what Hamas is expecting by way of further Israeli withdrawal or something. And I think Hamas was, in fact, I think this is a difference between this one difference and the deal that they could have had 5 months ago, a year ago, is that Hamas would have been in a better position to demand actual, tangible, concrete assurances that the, you know, everyone was going to deliver on their side of the deal. But if they're in the position of trusting Bibi and Trump to honor their word, I don't know. Good luck with that.
Do you think so? So you and I don't make a habit of saying nice things about Trump and
Trump.
I mean, yeah. For me, it's because I think he's an authoritarian psychopath who's funny. But as a lot of problems with him.
But the funny part is flattering, because you don't just mean weird. You think
he's quite quick on his feet and actually often very funny. But also he's like, I mean, some people in the YouTube comments may despise me for saying this, but the phrase "funny Hitler" keeps coming to mind. Having said that, I'm about to say something nice about Trump, which is. For different reasons, I think he could do things Biden can't. I think for one thing is he is such an irrational actor that his threats get taken seriously. He says outlandish things, but maybe he'll do them. Well, Biden won't have that. But also because he's a Republican. And I would feel that the Israeli right, maybe the Israeli population in general, don't like the Democrat. Don't feel the Democrats are on their side. Feel that they're anti-Semitic and hate Israel. While Trump could come in as a friend to Israel. And gets taken more seriously. Is that a fair analysis?
Well, first of all, Biden after October 7th was, you know, almost a parody of a friend. I mean, he went over and he hugged Bibi and he let him do whatever he wanted. And he never brought the hammer down. And people kept saying he's getting impatient, but he never did it. Look, any president who wanted results has the leverage. They just, if they really said, no, we're cutting off the weapons. You don't believe us? And they say, no, then you do it. You can do it if you're president.
But you're making my point in a different way. You're saying that in some way. Well, Biden has all of these levers he could use. But I'm not saying that. I'm saying that the Israelis feel Trump is on their side.
Well, they may. But the question is what Bibi felt. And I got to think Trump signaled that, no, he would actually use actual leverage. He was pissed. He was going to do something. Yeah. And you may say, well, it's more credible with Trump because he's a hard ass, but any president could demonstrate it by just doing it, by saying, no, okay, we're suspending weapons for a week. Okay, get it? We'll actually do this.
Any president could do this in the sense that it's within their presidential powers to do it. But from the standpoint of domestic policy, I am not sure a Democrat could do it as easily as a Republican.
Well, they both traditionally would face real political constraints doing it. The Republicans, both from donors. Trump has spoken very honestly about Miriam Adelson. He tells the story. She comes into the Oval Office. She says, what have you done for me lately? He says, it's always something for Israel. And I say, Miriam, I moved the embassy. I did this and this. And she always wants more. I mean, only Trump, right, would say this. But he does. So does that. They both have their donors. But then Trump has these evangelicals. And by the way, I do think an underemphasized factor in Trump finally playing hardball with Israel may have been that Trump was starting to worry about the Christian right's position on Israel, because Tucker Carlson was making a lot of noise about this from a specifically Christian standpoint. Marjorie Taylor Greene says, I've talked to Christian ministers who say this is genocide. You were starting to hear, Megyn Kelly was another one. I don't know how Christian the deal was, but I do think Trump was starting to work. You were definitely starting to hear from a certain sector of MAGA elites, pressure being put on Trump like saying, you know, he's being humiliated by Bibi and so on. And I think that may have been a factor. But both Republican and Democratic presidents have in recent decades felt great domestic political constraints. I mean, look, that's part of what Barry Weiss is about, to like enforce the speech code where if you criticize Zionism, you're an anti-Semite. That is part of the pressure that has traditionally been applied.
I think a lot of the rules that apply to everybody else don't apply to Trump.
I think
Trump, if he chose to, could have sanctioned or at least removed aid from Israel, and his supporters would stick with him through it in a way that George Bush or Biden's or Obama's wouldn't.
I don't know about, I mean, Biden, in terms of rank and file, I don't think it would be a big problem. It might be a problem with donors and various other things, but I don't think it's like raw number of votes. No, Trump has shown us that a lot of things that we thought were third rails you could touch, a lot of them in foreign policy. It goes back to when he said about John McCain, you know, before he was elected the first time, you know, he was somebody, you know, they're like, wait, you can't criticize. John McCain is a war hero. He was captured by the North Vietnamese. And Trump said something, well, I like people who don't get captured. The guy's plane was shot down. Yeah. And Trump is like calling him a wimp for winding up in enemy hands, you know. Trump gets away with a lot.
I mean, this whole thing planning to arrest his political enemies is something he's really leaning into. It used to be somewhat taboo.
He's violating all kinds of norms in the most alarming way on that front. Yeah, I'm worried. I mean, it's bad.
Yeah.
That reminds me, I wanted to find this. Do I have this quote from, what's his name? Stephen Miller. If I find it, that guy scares the hell out of me.
He's going to be a bad president once he takes over from Trump.
Yeah, the
I kid, because Stephen Miller scares the hell out of, I think, a lot of people, and he's not he doesn't have the affability of like a Tucker Carlson, who I could see as president.
Tucker doesn't always seem very affable. Have you listened to him lately? He's on the warpath. But J.D. Vance is also scary. I mean, the way Miller and Vance exploited the Charlie Kirk killing and tried to turn it into like the burning of the Reichstag almost was very worrisome.
My understanding was that people like Tucker Carlson kind of pulled him back on that a bit.
Well, they did, I think. I think they did on the free speech. Yeah. To the extent I was hoping some conservatives would stand up on the free speech issue after, in the wake of the Kirk assassination, they were trying to, you know, what were the various things? So for starters, the head of the FCC made sure and got Jimmy Kimmel suspended.
We talked about that, right?
Yeah, we did, I think. And some of the pushback came from the MAGA right on the free speech issues.
And Ted Cruz spoke up about it.
Well, I think when the attorney general, when Bondi, I think it was Bondi, who said, you know, we're going to go after hate speech. That was like a trigger for the right. It's like, no. We have spent the last 4 years saying that even hate speech is free speech.
Yeah. Which, by the way, I mean, to channel Greg Luganoff, there's no such thing as hate speech in the States as a legal category. You know, hate speech is perfect. It's speech.
Yeah, I really like Greg because he has been principled across the board on free speech issues. Now, what's his organization? FIRE? FIRE.
I think FIRE is one of the great American institutions. And whenever FIRE defends somebody, there's always people, they never defend people on the left, but they always defend people on the left. They defend people on the left. They defend people on the right. They are totally principled. I met with him a few times. We're not close friends, but friends. And very much on the side of angels.
Yep. So I don't know if I ranted enough. But look, I mean, it'll be so amazing if the thing holds in Gaza. That would be, I mean, just to end this would be nice. And it's funny, everyone is talking, people who know are talking like, yeah, it's going to stick. It's kind of a done deal. And I don't quite understand why they're so sure. But I do think that the three states have put so much pressure on Hamas, Qatar, Egypt, and Turkey, must have somehow convinced them that there are ways of feeling assured that the essentials of the deal will be honored. But I don't know what those ways are. If I were Hamas, I'd want Egyptian troops in there ASAP, or some kind of Arab troops, but we'll see. I mean, if I were any Palestinians, I would, because that's a way to keep the bombs from falling. If I were anybody in Gaza.
What else? AI? Elon Musk?
Yeah. Where should we go?
New novel by Ian McEwan.
Let me ask you, have you been hearing all this stuff about the AI, about how a bubble's about to burst on AI?
Or is it- yeah, like Derek Thompson had something about that. And Gary Marcus has become quite critical of AI.
Become?
I'm joking. So maybe it's a bubble. Look, is it possible that two things are true? One thing is AI has and will continue to increasingly transform our lives in massive ways, but it's also a bubble. It's also incredibly overvalued, and the whole stock market's gonna collapse and destroy all my savings.
Yep.
Yeah. So I think both may be true.
No, I think they are. I mean, there's some ill-advised money going places that aren't well advised.
I mean, I'll say one thing about the first point, which is there's all these views on AI and involved in a lot of arguments for this. And reading papers, I'm reading a paper with some colleagues about how AI makes the world too frictionless and talking about loneliness and so on. There's one view I have no patience with. And the view I have no patience with is, what good is it? How does it help you in your life? It's all overblown. I don't use AI and my life is great. And if you have the kind of job that you have or that I have, and you don't think AI is making your life easier, then you're just not using it right. You are telling on yourself, as the kids would say, because AI makes life so much easier in so many ways.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, this may sound weird. I've been so busy trying to get this AI book done that I haven't had time to really use AI that much. I mean, honestly, I have not had time to experiment as much as I'd like, but I don't really need to for purposes of the book. Which I finally sent in. But yeah, there are two conflations that don't necessarily make sense. One is the one you alluded to. There's a tendency for people who say this bubble's going to burst to also say this AI shit is nothing and it's being hugely hyped. And then the other one is on people tend to either say, man, this AI stuff is going to be so powerful and it's going to be so great, or to say it's not going to be so great and it's not going to be so powerful. My position is it's going to be super powerful and it's not necessarily going to be great, and we should be worried and doing a lot more to steer it towards.
So you had told me that you had finished the Yudkowsky book. Yudkowsky and who's the other guy?
Nate Soares.
Omar, yeah.
You and he are romantic rivals. Of course, because he's...
Oh, thank God nobody...
He's currently involved with your debate partner. Is that right?
My one-time debate partner, Ayla. I think they are... I don't know what they call in that community, but partners? Boyfriend, girlfriend?
Yeah, and that's what I just called you guys. You were her partner. He is her partner, hence the rivalry. Yeah.
In some way, that makes me his partner.
Uh-uh.
No, is it the transitivity doesn't work that way?
Are you sure you're an evolutionary psychologist?
No, yeah. So this is, not all interactions are non-zero sum.
Even I would say that.
But we've got, I have the book. I've started to read it and I started to listen to it on audio, but I have not made it very far, just other commitments. So will you say, how is it? You convinced?
Well, it's not that long, first of all. What surprised me is that there was almost no emphasis on what I thought there would be a certain amount of emphasis on. There may have been none, actually. I mean, generally, when you say to people, wait a second, if people don't know, Eliezer Yudkowsky is the Duma-in-chief for decades, for 15 years or so. He's been very worried. There was a time when he was a very, very enthusiastic, when he was a techno-optimist about AI. But anyway, he has, you know, laid out some of the fundamental tenets of what I call sci-fi doomerism. In other words, it isn't just that it's going to take a lot of jobs or this or that or help people make bioweapons. No, it's going to take over the planet and kill us. The name of his book, great title, If Anyone Builds It, Everyone Dies.
It's a good title.
Traditionally, when you say, you know, the first kind of skepticism you often get toward the sci-fi doom is, wait a second, AI's, they're not humans. Why would you think they had like some kind of thirst for power or something? That's a product of our evolutionary history.
Yeah.
The response to that is generally the subordinate goals thing. Well, you know, if you're smart enough, you realize that when anybody gives you a certain kind of goal, you may decide that power is the best path to get it. So they tell you to maximize the number of paper clips in the famous thought experiment. And you say, well, you mean maximize? Okay, here we go. I would, first of all, I'd like political control of planet Earth and blah, blah, blah. There's almost none of that. I mean, his big concern is, in a way, the sheer unpredictability of the future kind of evolution of AI.
Yeah.
And he's saying, you know, we cannot predict what its own preferences will be. And the analogy, you would like this, the analogy is to human evolution. It's like, okay, supposedly we were designed to get our genes into the next generation, right? Well, that led to certain goals like eating, like desiring nutritious food. Makes sense. But then in a modern environment, we are we like sweets that are not, like things that are not good for us because our sweet tooth evolved in an environment where sweet things were good for us. Or another one is we use contraception and thwart what was supposedly, defeat the whole supposed purpose of natural selection to maximize genetic proliferation and so on. So it's that kind of, and I'm having trouble in my mind drawing a precise enough analogy. I mean, in my book, it's all about AI evolution. I'm using the evolutionary paradigm throughout at various levels, but I still, he's right about the general unpredictability. He's certainly right that we don't understand how these things work at a deep level. I mean, generically, we kind of do, but we don't really know what's going on inside them. That's all true. And look, I think it's cause for concern. I'm saying the same thing, but I was surprised by the emphasis on that one thing that, like, because it isn't just that, well, we don't know, bad shit could happen. His argument is that we know for sure that if you let this thing get smart enough, it will have desires and goals that we can't predict, and inevitably at least some of them will be at odds with our own goals in a very consequential way. That's kind of the argument.
And I've heard you, Yudkowsky, talk about this on podcasts and I think on a TED talk, where in earlier incarnations he made it sound almost like a mathematical proof. It's simply, once you build these things, this is a certainty that they will kill us all, and there's nothing to do about that. And the book seems to take a sort of milder tack, which I find also pretty convincing, which is it's hard to figure out what's going to happen if we invite a super intelligent being, set of beings into our midst to have power over us. You know, I think you might allow the ideas that may be merciful to us and, you know, cure cancer and solve world peace and let us flourish, but you don't know that. And consider how humans deal with other entities that are less intelligent and less capable than us, and often we just exterminate them, not because of some crazy, you know, we get rid of all insects because we want to build, you know, we're worried about this, or because are we put the chimpanzees in zoos, or we do this stuff. So what are they going to do to us? And I find that kind of convincing.
I guess, I mean, I think, he's still, I think, first of all, I think he still thinks it just kind of follows almost deductively that we are toast. I don't think he rules out the possibility that if we stop, if we paused AI for long enough, we could figure it out and build an aligned superintelligence. But I think he still believes it follows pretty much inexorably that we're toast if we don't do that, or that the chances are overwhelmingly high that we're toast.
Yeah. And, well, no one's going to stop AI. So we're going to find out.
Yeah. We'll see. I mean, it's not impossible, but it would take a pretty big catastrophe to get the degree of international coordination it would take to even slow it down significantly.
That's actually the science fiction scenario, right? For Dune and Battlestar Galactica. And I think one of the incarnations of Star Trek, the story has always been that there was a robot uprising or an AI uprising that killed millions and millions of people, but didn't kill everybody, didn't succeed, and then we shut it down.
It happens a lot. I mean, it's amazing that the HAL scenario has actually, you know, kind of been observed.
Sorry, what scenario?
HAL in 2001.
Oh, yes.
A Space Odyssey.
Yeah, yeah.
Mainly in the tests of the AI, but yeah, it's like, If it catches wind of somebody's attempt to shut it down, it has been observed going to great efforts to prevent that. So should we go into overtime, which, by the way, is available to paid subscribers who also have the opportunity.
If you subscribe to my Substack, would there be any deal on your Substack?
You know, it's funny you should mention that, Paul. My understanding is that if you're a paid subscriber to my Substack. Wait, which question did you ask? It works both ways. If a paid subscriber to yours, they get a 50% discount to mine, and vice versa. I think that's the deal.
So
a 1-year subscription.
We could talk about the McEwen novel. We could talk about the movie you just saw. I saw it too. One battle after another. Curious what you think of it.
Yeah. What else? Was there a third? Oh, I saw most of a good George Harrison documentary. It's not new, but it's never ceases to be interesting. Also I could plug my daughter's rock and roll band. Okay. They got a shout out from this guy, Bob Boylan, who started All Songs Considered when he was producer of All Things Considered. He has a like some kind of podcast or something, but that's bonus content. You don't get that for free. You don't get me promoting members of my family for free, folks.
No,
what kind
of deal
do you think this is? You gotta pay for it.
And then you get 50% off me promoting my family.
Yeah. And more about AI, I want to mention a couple of developments in AI. I do think the most underreported story about OpenAI, there's been a lot that was reported, like this Sora. Have you seen the Sora social media channel?
I've heard of it. I haven't played with it yet.
Yeah. But the thing I'm talking about flew under the radar, but is momentous. Trust me.
Okay.
So we are about to go into overtime. Thanks, everybody, followed us so far. We encourage you to join us
for
the rest of the journey.